One person videotaped us crashing, and that's where it became famous.
Today, I have a guest that you've seen before. 27 years ago, he was in an airplane crash, which was televised, and it's changed his life profoundly. And I told him I wanted to dedicate just a separate podcast just to that. Let's talk with Ron. Ron, I want to thank you so much for coming back.
You're welcome.
To I'm talk about to this. It. 27 years ago, you were in a plane crash.
That's right.
What was it? Tell me, give me the details.
As you know from our previous discussions, I had been traveling heavily around the world. About every 2 months, I would go to some block of the world. South America, I would go to two or three countries, and I would be traveling for 2 or 3 weeks. I would be traveling, then I'd come back to Japan, and then a month or two after that, I would travel somewhere else in the world. And basically what I was doing is I was giving sales seminars, and I was going to the developing world, so you cannot just go to one group and one seminar and then leave and go back to Japan. It's just too costly and doesn't warrant it, so I'd have to go to about three countries. Of about anywhere from 10 to 20 people in each seminar. And for example, if I went to South America, I would go to Argentina, Chile, and maybe I went to Paraguay a lot, once to Brazil, and that would be a group trip, and then I would go back to Japan. And this carried on for, I think, around 16, 17 years.
I was traveling alone?
I was traveling alone at the end, or I should say after the beginning. In the early stages, because they were actually, it was a job that I really created more than a job that was given to me. Here's a job, you want it? Here's the pay, and blah, blah, blah. I didn't have that. This is a problem that the company had about they could not sell the vehicle, and the customer would only ask for discounts because they say, I can't sell, it's too expensive. And they found that it was not the expense or the price of the product, it was that the salespeople really didn't understand what they were selling. They didn't know the product, they didn't know the customer, they didn't know the competitor. So I had to teach those things, and armed with that strong sales, let's say, activity, then we can start talking about, are you competitive? Is the competitor more expensive and better than yours? Then you can start. But if you don't know anything about anything, how can you start to negotiate? Right. And so that's how it started. And it took me a year to convince people that overseas sales training is valuable. It took me a year to do that.
How long did it take it for them to realize it was valuable after you started?
Well, I started in the smallest countries of the world where I couldn't do too much damage. And then after the first year, it was not, when we say they, the dealers picked up very quickly that they need this training. They're the customers, right? And then later on, Isuzu Motors, within the sales departments, they started to understand it, and then it gradually went from the weakest, smallest, who cares about that market first, and then gradually got to bigger and bigger markets. So I was starting to work with General Motors, where they had assembly plants, and those assembly plants sold to their dealers, and obviously the dealers sold to the user. Then it got bigger and bigger and bigger, but it took, 10 years or so to get to
that level. But they saw it from the beginning, that they could see some progress in it, especially because the dealers were really grateful that you came to tell them about the product.
They were, particularly in the developing world, with honestly, people don't care economically about the developing world.
I understand.
They only care if there's raw materials there, they can extract.
Well, they can see some money
being made. They're interested in extracting that, but other than that, honestly, the business world doesn't care.
Right.
And so, of all those countries that I work with, most of them had some kind of raw materials. Sometimes we'd be working with the Japanese trading company. They would extract some kind of raw materials. Therefore, they get foreign exchange, and those countries need trucks, so you can sell them the trucks and so on. And I've only been to three countries without really good foreign exchange. One was Ethiopia, which we'll talk about. The other is Tanzania, and the third was Sri Lanka. Those countries really don't have the foreign exchange. They have to rely on aid. So the business community, they really don't care, except they will sell to a government who provides something to them for free.
In some way, right.
So it'd be something like that. But getting back to our project, I had been traveling so heavily over those years I didn't want to travel anymore, really, even at that time. And it was interesting is the trip just before this plane crash trip, I went to Turkey and had the most wonderful business trip I've ever been on. They had not had a new truck for over 9 years or so. They were begging for a new product. The competitors were beating us up badly, particularly the Italians, the Iveco truck. So we needed something really good. We needed to put it in a very, very nice place or else the dealers wouldn't come back to us. So it was just a wonderful, wonderful trip. And at that time I thought, well, I don't want to travel anywhere. I didn't want to travel anymore and such. And I thought, well, geez, this is really exciting though. I want to keep this up as much as I possibly can. But anyway, they put it in all the tourist spots around Turkey. And I went to 5 locations. So that was a wonderful trip. And then the next trip. The next trip I started by going, here was going to several months later, going from Tokyo, obviously, to Germany where I changed planes. And the main purpose of that trip was to go to Kenya. Kenya had a General Motors assembly plant. They had 8 dealers, and I'm going to train those dealers on this new truck. So that's the most important part of the trip. But they asked me, could you go to Ethiopia, because it's just next door, and give them a seminar? They have no money. We've got a little dealer there. We just want to provide them something that we care. Just go there. So I said, well, sure, you know, it's on the way. So anyway, I flew to Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. That's the capital of Ethiopia. And I gave my seminar. I enjoyed the Ethiopian people, fascinating people. And that's where coffee is from?
Mm-hmm.
That's
yes.
The mocha coffee.
The mocha coffee, right.
That's the mocha coffee. So you never talk about Ethiopian coffee, nobody knows, but everyone knows mocha.
They do.
Just like down in Kenya, everyone knows Kilimanjaro coffee.
Right, right.
But anyway, that's where coffee is from. And other things about Ethiopia is quite fascinating. But anyway, I gave my seminar, and then I was to go, obviously, from Addis Ababa down to Nairobi, where I was going to give my Kenya seminar. But the plane was hijacked. So there were hijackers. There were 3.
This is the plane that crashed?
Yes.
All right, so you get on the plane. You didn't suspect anything, of course.
No, I just...
You just got on the plane. You're doing the regular day.
Started talking to the lady sitting next to me.
How big of the plane? How big of a plane was it?
It was a 7... I think it was a 767. So there was... 175 people on board.
Okay.
And 3 people that wanted to hijack the plane. They wanted to go to Australia, believe it or not. They hijacked the plane. They charged the cockpit, went into the cockpit.
Did you see this? Where were you
sitting?
Yeah,
I saw them run to the cockpit. I was in front. I was in business class 8B. And right next to me is a lady from India, 8A. Mm-hmm. And her, we're in contact to this day.
Okay, so she's, how many people died on the plane?
About 125.
How many survived?
The remaining of, so 20-something.
20-something people.
Wait a minute now, let me get my math right.
Okay.
There was 175 on the plane, and 125, not counting injuries, 125 died, so what is that?
50 people. 50 people
survived. So around 50 people, 40 people survived.
Yeah, survived.
Not counting them having injuries. And the lady, she has permanent injuries. Her ankle is just like an L. She can't move her ankle at all.
Understand.
It's just like an L shape. Right. They tried to operate on it because they can never really get it back to normal.
Okay, so you get on the plane, you guys take off. And then when did it happen?
It was about 20 minutes into the flight. They started serving drinks, I remember, at that time. So you had the carts in the middle of the aisles. So the 3 hijackers, they were jumping over the armrests to get to the front, and there were 3 of them. And so they took control of the aircraft, and they said they wanted to go to Australia. And the pilot tried to convince them that we don't have the fuel to go to Australia. We've got to go down to Nairobi to be refueled, because even though it's Ethiopian Airlines, their hub is the hub of the aircraft is in Nairobi. They have the equipment and such, so they've got to go down there for refueling and then such.
What were you doing at this time? Did you know what was going on by then?
I knew something was happening. And it was strange, Lance, at that time, it was really strange for me that I had no stress. I thought, well, okay, this is another adventure. And I travel so much, and I don't want to travel anymore.
You said, wait. You didn't know it was a hijacking yet, or you already knew it was a hijacking?
I knew it was a hijacking.
Well, how'd you know that? What did they say?
I could see right into the cockpit, and they're yelling and screaming and all this kind of thing going on. I said, something is not right here. And so I knew it was a hijacking and such.
What flight was this? Do you know? Remember the flight?
ET-961. You can Google it, and you can see the airplane crashing and everything.
So it's
ET-961. Ethiopian Airlines Flight 961.
And what year was this?
1996. November 23rd.
27 years ago. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you see the people rush the cockpit.
Yeah.
And you see there's commotion up there.
Yeah.
And you said you had no stress. You were just relaxed.
Yeah. It's the funny thing is, I had been through the air crash safety rules so many times, and I'm in the automobile business, so I know about frontal impact and everything.
Okay.
And so I thought we're going to have to land on the wall. We're going to land somewhere else. And as I mentioned earlier, I was so tired of traveling at that time, and so tired of speaking in front of groups and trying to promote people to sell things. And then I thought, this was a fun adventure for me. I had a different attitude. I didn't think that I would die, or I didn't think about it. I hear again, I'm the motivation guy. I am the positive guy. I am the optimistic guy. That's what I've got to do to move people to improve their sales or whatever they're trying to do.
But you had a family now already. Didn't you have your kids?
Yeah, I had my kids. As a matter of fact, my wife was angry about me that I wasn't worried about the family. If I die, weren't you worried about me? And they said, no, I wasn't worried about you because I wasn't worried about me. It's a funny thing. I don't understand it. Lance, I really don't understand, but that was the way I was feeling at that time.
Yeah.
I am optimistic. We're going to get the lady next to me. She wants to pray, and she's worrying and a lot of things.
Did you hear any other commotion in the plane? Were people
crying?
Yeah,
there were people crying. There were people angry, particularly in economy class.
How? They were making, were they saying
anything? Making noise, and what's going on, and we're supposed to go to Nairobi, and I don't know what are you doing about this? And three people, I didn't realize this, and after, three people were considering attacking the hijackers. And I heard on the announcement, we're in a hijack situation. Please don't do anything. Please remain in your seat and such. And some people had to go to the bathroom, and you had to ask them if they could go to the bathroom.
Wait, the hijackers, did they have guns or anything?
No, they had what looked like, they said it was a bomb.
Okay.
And actually, it was a fire extinguisher. And I don't believe it was a bomb, but one guy's holding a fire extinguisher
saying it's a bomb.
And saying, this is a bomb. And they had knives and some other things, to my understanding. In the cockpit, we couldn't see that. But as I say, I had this optimistic attitude, and I wasn't under that much stress at that time. Later on, yes, I was. When I had my injuries, then it's crashed in the ocean, and I'm obviously swimming amongst a lot of dead people. Ooh. And I had to get out. It was a water landing.
So take me through it. I mean, as it went through.
Okay.
So how long did this whole thing last? After you found out it was a hijacking, how much time do you think passed by?
About 3 hours.
You guys
were cruising around, and the pilot says, yes, we're going toward Australia, but actually he's not. He's circling, but the pilots don't, the hijackers don't
Can't
know
tell.
It.
Right.
And then as we're cruising around for the longest time, he said, listen, we're running out of fuel. We've got to land or else we're going to crash. And the hijacker said, well, we want to create destiny or something. This is our life or something like that. We don't care.
Where were they from? The hijackers.
Ethiopia,
okay.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I was on German TV, and the Germans, they did real good research. It was a 45-minute research of the plane crash. They went down to Ethiopia. They interviewed people. They had an Israeli military group in the back in economy class. They were there. There were 11 people, of which 10 died. Only one guy survived. He was interviewed. They interviewed the parents of the hijackers in Ethiopia. They really researched it well. So I learned a lot of things from these TV programs. And I've been on, I don't know, 6, 7 television programs. Five or six in the U.S., 2 here in Japan, 1, as I mentioned, in Germany. In different places, they interviewed me, and they interviewed a lot of other people. So there's a lot of TV coverage of this. And it was, the event was simply because the pilot was looking for a place to land so we could be taken care of, and he found the Comoro Islands. There was a beach hotel, so he just gradually worked his way, and he crashed right in front of the beach hotel. So the people on the beach are watching us crash. And one person videotaped us crashing, and that's where it became famous, because of that videotaping.
And they show the wing hit, and then the plane start to disintegrate.
Yes, you can see it on YouTube.
Right.
You can
right.
see the
well,
plane.
Well, I saw it. I looked at it.
Yeah, okay.
Because you sent me the information. So right. you see it, it kind of banks to the left, and the left wing hits, and then the plane just starts to
right.
fall
I think
apart.
It hits a reef underneath the water.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay.
Or else it should, right. by engineering, it should be able to actually land on the water, and then you get your boats and, you know.
So what happened? What was it like for you inside the plane during that time? What do you
well,
remember?
Well, we were lucky. We were really lucky because I knew that, well, let me just explain. I knew frontal impact. I know about airbags. I know about seat belts, the importance of seat belts. People don't die in crashes of, you know, when an automobile hits another automobile, you don't die. You die because your head and your whole body flies. It flies right into the windshield, and that's where you die. That's why the seat belt is so important and the airbag is important. And this happens from the point of the crash, your head hitting the windshield is less than a second. It's less than a blink. And we actually, when I was in the training center, we had the service people had an airbag. They said, we're going to explode an airbag. Come look at it. So we all look around. Okay, it's going to explode. You think it's going to be a balloon blow me up, right? You can't tell from 1 second to the next. It's not there. It's there. You can't detect, it's that fast. So it clings to you so fast that whatever you're crashing into, you're going to be pinned to the seat, you're not going to fly. So that's what saves you. I knew that one, and I instructed the lady next to me, what we're going to do is we're going to take our pillows, we're going to push it in the front of the seat in front of us. And I know this is counterintuitive, but what we're going to do is we're going to put our head against the front and seat in front of it, and we're going to be pushing forward. Because when there is impact, we're not going to fly. All of the impact is going to be on the seat in front of us. So I have no neck injuries. I had the plane cracked right in front of us. So I was fighting through insulation, then all of a sudden, we're still in our seat with our seat belt. And we're floating. We're just a piece of the aircraft. And we're floating on the ocean, and gradually I could see the ocean. And so we were basically outside from the crash. We were in front, and the plane cracked away, and we were just sitting so we could go outside. Now,
but you had to take off your seatbelt.
Yeah, I first I inflated my vest, then I said, I'm gonna take off my seatbelt and swim into the ocean. And I was swimming and jogging, as I said, because of the heavy travel, I had to stay in shape. So I was swimming and jogging a lot, going down to the gym and jogging in the morning before going to work. So my legs were strong and my heart was strong and my arms were relatively strong for the little swimming that I did. So I was in good shape. And so I dislocated my seatbelt, and I fell in the ocean. She said, take me with you.
Wait just a minute, Ron, but before you hit, you weren't calm then. When the plane landed, you weren't calm, were you? Because were you still calm at that time too, do you think, in your mind? You had your head up against the pillow.
I think this is what anyone, when is in those kind of traumas, you can't say calm or nervous. You're on automatic pilot. You're going as fast as possible. Someone is shooting at you, you're not going to think, am I stressed over this problem? You're not thinking about that. You're thinking about the shooter and what to do. You're thinking minute to minute on what do I do here, what do I do here, what do I do here? That's all you're thinking about. After that, the stress will come in.
Okay.
And all the people that have been heroic in battle, at the time of the battle, they're not thinking about
anything,
life
but
or
just
death.
They're doing what they have to do.
They're thinking about what I have to do at this minute to survive this situation.
Because your body's full of adrenaline right now.
Adrenaline, what do I do? What do I do now? Right. Now, that plane right there, it's got an edge right there. If I went over there, it's going to cut me. I stay away from that. I'll get into the water.
You could see.
I'm thinking about all of those things.
You could see it. The plane
I could see the airplane.
Because it broke apart. It was broken apart.
Yeah, it's all broken apart.
And bodies, you didn't see any bodies everywhere.
Yeah, I did. They're all floating in the ocean.
Okay, all right, so go on.
And so, anyway, so we broke away. We're the lucky ones that most of the people who were in economy class, they drowned simply because they had no escape. And a lot of them inflated their vests. They went to the ceiling, stuck there, and drowned. That's where most of the economy people. The first class people, believe it or not, the high price first class people, they all died.
Why? Because first impact.
I don't know. Yeah, right. Yeah, probably
impact.
But anyway, so I was in the ocean, and then the lady sitting next to me, her name is Ronnie Nankani. We're close, and now we both have grandchildren and all that. We talk about these things, and we always think about what would happen if we would have never seen our grandchildren. This would never have happened. And I had to change my career after that. I had a whole new career. The sales training had started, and then I was in overseas sales after that in a different company, which I talked about last time. And that was the European and the American market. That would all took place, which would not have placed, obviously, if I'd have been killed in the accident. So anyway, I'm in the ocean, and she says, please take me with you. She can't swim. I said, okay. And so I swam back to her. I inflated her vest, get the vest on first, inflated her vest. Then I dislocated her seatbelt, and she just fell on me, basically. And I said, grab my neck. So she grabs my neck in the front and tell me where I'm going because I'm going to swim in that direction. And so I paddle backwards. I'm paddling backwards. And I want to get away from all this debris. And the vest are so lance. You don't get your nose wet. The buoyancy is way down here. Here's the water level down here. And your head is way up here. It's so relaxing. If you're a swimmer, you probably wouldn't even need the vest, but even if you're a non-swimmer, you don't know how to swim, you don't know anything, you can just float along. Nope. It's so wonderful. So anyway, I said, listen, I am going to just get away from the debris, and then we'll just sit out in the ocean. And so I start swimming backwards, and she's watching where to go. And she says, hey, there's a boat over there. And I said, there's a boat? Really? And I said, yeah. And she can see, yeah, and there's a beach over there. We didn't know we were crashing, but we were crashing right in front of the Comoro Islands. It was a beach hotel. And the Comoros are an ex-French territory. So it's equivalent to like our Hawaii, but it's not, it's an independent country now, but it was a French territory. And just at that time, there happened to be doctors from France on vacation, on the beach, in their swimming suit. And they're the people that took care of us.
Oh my goodness.
And so anyway, we find a boat, we swim to the boat,
Now you have no pain or anything in your body at this time?
My leg was dislocated, so my leg was kind of like in this shape.
Okay, right.
Okay, my leg was it was locked. There was no pain, but I couldn't straighten my leg.
Okay.
And her ankle was broken at the ankle to the point where it was just kind of like hanging on a piece of skin.
I understand.
And hers, actually, it was broken three places.
Right.
But she says, my foot is broken. And I said, okay, well, Will they just work through that? And I don't know how much pain she was in. I don't think so. I think it was full adrenaline.
Right, right. So she didn't feel anything at that time, right?
Yeah. So anyway, we were into the ocean. We found the boat. The boat is a little, small boat. And they took us to the shore. From the shore, different kind of vans and trucks came around, and they took us to what would be equivalent to a makeshift clinic. And you can see this here again on YouTube, that makeshift, and I think I showed you a few pictures of me in there. It's really a makeshift clinic, of which hardly any doctors, but the doctors who were on vacation, they're the ones that were in there saving lives and taking care of people.
They're all French?
Huh?
Were they all French?
Yeah, they were all French. So we, and the people that found me, the Isuzu Motors people, they didn't know where I was, because they were all waiting for me in Nairobi. All the General Motors people were waiting for me to receive my seminar. They're all waiting for him, and they said, "Well, he's not coming," and so I missed that seminar course. So, but the General Motors and the Isuzu Motors, they didn't know where I was. The FBI, because I'm an American, they knew that there were Americans on the airplane. There were five of us.
Five of you. How many made it?
Three.
Okay.
And two died. Of two Japanese, one died.
One died, okay.
On the airplane. So anyway, we were in that little clinic. We're in that clinic, and they were trying to find out. These people all have to go to a real hospital, and there's no hospital in the Comoros. So we had a choice of three places: going back to Nairobi, or going to Nairobi, going to Johannesburg, South Africa, or going to another French territory, the island of Reunion. And on Reunion, there was a famous hospital in that area. I wanted to go to Johannesburg. That would be the best of the best. I wanted to go to Johannesburg. But they wouldn't let me go there. Why? They wouldn't let me, because that plane was full, mostly of South Africans. So they wouldn't let me go there. And Kenya, I had food poisoning once in Kenya on an earlier trip, so I don't want to go there either. Okay. So the Comoros, Reunion was the last choice. So I said, okay, I'll go there. I'll go to, and it was the French Foreign Legion's airplane. It was always the military airplane that they use in kind of a combat situation, where nothing but cots and such in the airplane. I was on that plane with the lady next to me.
In your cot, lying down.
Yeah, she was in one cot, and I was in another cot. And we
How long of a flight? How long of a flight? Do you know?
Oh my gosh, I don't know. Maybe 2 hours or so.
So
When
did the adrenaline go away and you started to think, wow?
I guess in Reunion.
Oh, not until you got to Reunion.
Yeah, I guess in Reunion. I had actually it was interesting. My leg was reconnected. It was my hip was dislocated. That's why I couldn't stream. My hip was dislocated. And I don't know if you know about hip injuries, but if you have a hip injury and it's dislocated, it'll either break here or break up here and then release. If it breaks here, you're gonna lose the blood circulation. That's where you have to have reconstructive surgery on your hip, your bone, femur, I think it is. Mm-hmm. But for me, it broke up here, and once it was relocated, naturally you have to wait and see if the vessels will start renovate themselves and such. And then will blood flow? If blood doesn't flow, then here again, you're going to have reconstructive surgery of that area. So anyway, so I had this leg injury, and the doctors in Reunion put me under gymnastry, and they set my leg. They set my leg, and here is my leg, and they set it at the hip, obviously. And I had this cast on my ankle. And I thought, what the hell, they put a cast on my ankle where my hip is the damaged part. And they put that cast on the ankle so I would not move my leg, which would damage the ankle. So and that was fascinating for me. But anyway, it was there for about 6-10 hours in the Comoros. And then the plane here again to Reunion was another 2-3 hours, I suppose. We had to go by ambulance to the airplane and such and go down there. And then once in Reunion, then the trauma really started to kick in.
What was it like?
And I couldn't sleep. I always shaking all the time. Couldn't sleep. During the day, I was relatively calm. But at night, then I couldn't sleep, so I had a medication. And that went on for about 6 months. That trauma went on for 6 months. And trauma never really goes away. You just kind of live with it, I suppose. Right. But it weakens. I should say it weakens, but it never really goes away.
Right. What do you mean? Sometimes that might happen while you're sleeping still?
Yeah, sometimes. Sometimes I'll envision, you know, some kind of situation where, for example, you're locked up, maybe some, you're stuck in a pipe and you can't get out, and it shocks you and wakes you up. Those kind of nightmares and such. Yeah, they're still around. They're weaker than before, but before I had to have medication to get to sleep, or I couldn't do it. But anyway, because of all this event, and it was funny because before the plane crash, I thought, I've traveled so much. I've done so many wonderful things. If I die right now, I don't care. I've done so many wonderful things.
How old were you at that time?
I was in my 50s.
Okay.
Maybe late 40s, around that area. And I've had such a wonderful, and I thought that's the worst thing I should think. Because I don't know.
Wouldn't you think that?
Because
later, you mean?
Huh?
You mean later? You start at that time.
After
that's
the
what
plane
you
crash, I was saying to myself, "You have a bad attitude.
Okay.
You should never ever say this is good enough. This is the end. You never know where that next adventure will come from. You never know the excitement that's going to come next. So don't think, all right, I'm done enough. This is good enough. This is good enough. I don't need any more. You never know what calling, what adventure, what experience, what support you're going to provide to someone, what joy you're going to create. You never know that. So life, even if I was in an iron lung and I could think, I still think there's maybe an adventure there because I can think. It's the strangest things, and things come at us that we don't expect. I didn't expect to come to Japan. Not until I got into San Jose and in the university. I didn't expect that. And I hated sales. I thought that was just terrible, pushy, people harassing each other. I didn't
Ron,
like
tell
sales.
Me some of the things, since you've had the airplane crash 27 years ago, what are some of the things that have happened to you from then till now that you're happier alive because of it?
Well, here again, I have granddaughters now that I didn't have at that time. I had to leave Isuzu Motors, not really my responsibility, but the company financially was getting worse and worse and worse and worse. And the Japanese market was getting weaker and weaker. In spite of the company exporting more than they sold in Japan, the profits were really in Japan, and we were picking up little pieces, really. And when the Japanese market started to shrink, you remember the downturn and the bank changes, so the entire Japanese economy started to die. Isuzu Motors, their shares, when I was in Isuzu Motors, most of the time, the share was in around the 700 yen area. When I left the company, it was at 36 yen.
36 yen?
Yeah, it was dogging, it was scrap. This is a bankrupt company. It was a scrap company, and of course they had to let go about 2/3 of their staff just to survive, and they had to renegotiate with General Motors. So anyway, I left the company, and you know, my wife has said, don't leave the big company because it's more secure, and you're over 50 years old at that time, so you're not going to get another job. And I thought, with all those sales training years, I think I can do something.
This is after the airplane crash too?
Yes, certainly after. several years after. And by the way, I did go to Kenya. I did give my seminar. I did travel for another 5-6 years before I left the company. So I did finally, in other words, I'm the returning hero going to Nairobi to all those salespeople that were waiting for me before. And I said, yeah, we can get things done. So I had to rebuild and regenerate. And then anyway, I left Isuzu Motors. I found another job, which opened up the whole American and European markets for me. I've never traveled around most of the cities in America. Now, all of a sudden, I'm providing a product. And that product is mostly promoted through a conference every year. That conference is held in different cities every year. And they have to have nice, touristy kind of cities, or no one will come. Similar to what I was mentioning earlier. So I'm giving exhibitions at those conferences. Conferences, and I did that for, I gave my own presentation, I had my own booth, and I gave my own presentation for about 3 years, and after that I started what you call private label business. So I sell my product, but it's under the customer's name, not the manufacturer's name. It's OEM business, they also use that term. So anyway, I'm selling through an OEM network, of which it's all private label. So when I go there, I am the supplier, I'm not the customer. So I stopped exhibiting because I didn't want to compete with my customers in the conference. Because it's my product under his name, my product under his name, and here I am. People will come to me as opposed to go to those suppliers, and I didn't want to compete directly. So I went there, you know, just like I am right now, just quietly going around. And of course, the customers knew I would. And I said, "How you doing?" And then, "Do you have any problems with deliveries, new products, and stuff?" So that whole world started after that. And I did the same thing in Europe. It was always in Cologne. There was a major exhibition in Cologne, which I exhibited for 3 years, and then after that, here again, private label business again. And then once it was in Spain, in Bilbao. So that all came out. So what I'm trying to say is my world from, okay, I'm finished here, to you never know what's going to come. You that's never right. know what's going to come.
That's right.
So that's what I was trying to say. So all of those adventures happened after the plane crash.
After the plane crash. Where are you today? Again.
Today, I'm enjoying writing articles.
And you're 75 now, right?
I'm 75.
75, okay.
I'm writing articles, I'm giving speeches.
What type of articles?
Usually it's on overseas business related or international relations related, or it's sometimes, recently I've been talking about human energy, how do we keep ourselves motivated and strong. It's not just physical health, our mental. Our brain uses more energies than anything else. So our mental processing over age, it goes down. So how do we keep our mentally active? Another, how do we keep ourselves motivated? And then the third is, it's kind of spiritual in nature, but when you do something for other people, you get energy. You know, it's that, you know, what is it? Giving is more rewarding than receiving.
That's true.
Well, that is an energizing type of thing. It could go into a religion. It could be just servicing your community, whatever it is. And the last one, the obvious one, of course, is your physical health. If you stay physically healthy, you will be energized. And I try to keep my legs strong. I try to keep my heart strong. And that will keep me mobile. That keep me moving around. So I'm excited about it. So I've been talking about that. We're living in a country that is aging rapidly.
That's right.
They're interested in that subject.
They are.
So I've given that speech twice here, and that's been in English. I have given it in Japanese. I don't want to give presentations in Japanese anymore for that same reason. It's more fatiguing than it is energizing. In English, even after the seminar, I'm pretty excited.
Because that's your native language, and you're hearing what you're saying. Emotionally, it affects you differently. Because you can't speak. You can't give an English-based speech in Japanese and have it have the same meaning any more than you can do the opposite. Take a Japanese-based speech and do it in English and have it the same meaning. Because the nuances are different.
Yeah, you're bringing up, you coming from the education profession, you know that words have meanings, but they also have feelings.
Exactly.
And we can, let's say in English, we can say things, the same thing in terms of meaning, three or four ways. They all have different, they all have the same meaning, but different feelings behind them. And if we want to deliver that same feeling, particularly on a topic like energy, that same motivational feeling, that's harder to do in a second language.
And I think people can feel that too. It's hard for them to get that. Your energy doesn't radiate the same way because you're not using the same words, the words you grew up using. It won't mean the same. Even if you're mad, you can't be mad in Japanese the way you can be mad in English. Yeah. You can't be excited in Japanese the same way you can be in English. You're taking on something that isn't part of your emotional makeup. Right. Because that happens between the age from birth to 12, unless something traumatic happens.
If you work with the Europeans a lot, you'll know that. Because you'll go, and the Europeans are all wonderful people, but they're all, a lot of them are speaking in their second language.
That's right.
And so their language is fine, it's perfect, it's wonderful, but it's less impactful or less, it doesn't have that emotional impact behind it, simply because they're filtering through another language.
That's right. Ron, we did this before, but I want to ask you again, before I end this podcast, if you were to go back in time, I want to hear what you say this time, and meet the younger Ron, based upon everything you know now, and give him advice, what advice would you give him, and how old would you be?
Well, since we're talking about my plane crash, let's call that our point of time and age and such, and this could be even an older person, but this is what I was alluding to earlier. I would say to that person, never give up on life, because the next adventure, you really don't know what that will be, and that may be a game changer. And it can, if you reach this level, that doesn't mean it's the end. You can still maybe achieve this level or this level. And as I say, I'm writing articles I never wanted to write before, but that's very, very motivating for me. And I can do it from home. Extremely motivating. And now we have tools we can do from our smartphone, from our home and such. So we have opportunities that I would never dream of before that time. So that would be my thought.
Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for watching or listening to this podcast. And always remember, it's all on loan, so continue to reach for the stars.
Because you're too blessed to be stressed.